This is a Pinball News production.
Yeah, so this is an interesting presentation for me to give. Thank you, Rob, for inviting me. I'm going to actually start with the end of the story first. Because it's a long story, I'm going to give you a little technology, a little history, and a little information about these pinball machines. But it all started when I decided to move to Florida. And I am now I'm from New York, as you probably got from my accent, but now I live in Florida, a little town called Punta Gorda, and that just generally means I'm old. Because when I moved in, they got this place here that they opened in the strip mall called the Oxygen Superstore, which is absolutely the truth. And both slips have handicap stickers, which just threw me for a loop. And they have a thing in Florida called silver alerts. That's when grandpa steals the car and nobody knows where he's going. The best part about this, though, are the early birds, because you can get a burger with cheese, lettuce, tomato, pickle, and onion for $3.75, and it includes a free draft beer. So there's a lot of good things about living in Florida. Now, what happened was, and why Florida is relevant, is because there are no basements. And when I moved from New York, we had a rather large house, and in the basement, I had a pinball machine. And how I got that pinball machine and where it came from is really the story. And Rob sort of said how it ended, and it ended as when I sold the house, I had to get rid of the pinball machine. And what happened was, I couldn't fit it in the new house in Florida. And I couldn't get anybody to take it. So I put it on eBay, and I actually thought it was worth something because I thought it was really unique. Has anybody ever played a coffee mat pinball machine? Wow. Wipeout, Star Battle, which one? Really? So I thought it had some history because I was involved in it since the beginning, because it turns out my dad's company made the electronics for that pinball machine, and that's where the story goes. So let me take you through this. Who am I? I have a little software company in New York, and yes, I live in Florida, but the company's in New York, and we make software for manufacturing companies, inventory control, customer service, e-business parts ordering, so that's what we do. I am not into the gaming programming side of the business, although my business is slightly technical, but this is not what we do. Previously, I was a program manager for a government electronics company, Numax Electronics. And we were a defense contractor. We made night vision equipment, lights for tanks, weapon systems, and we made the electronics for a pinball machine. Now, why is that? Well, in the 70s, we said we got to diversify and get into the commercial business. And we found that the microprocessor, the 8080, Intel just came out with it. It was really groundbreaking. So we were approached by Coffee Mat Amusement Division, Kenilworth, New Jersey, and said, we know nothing about electronics. Can you guys make the electronics pack for our pinball machine? And so that was the marriage that happened. So my dad's company, Numax, was asked to make the electronics pack for Wipeout. And that started on a journey of really creating the first solid-state machine now. I think it's the first solid-state machine. And why I think that is because the reason we got involved in it was because it was going to be lucrative, because we would be breaking new ground. There might have been parallel efforts. Somebody might have got a footprint out before we did. I really can't answer that. But I do want to say that it's probably, if it's not the first, it's one of the first solid-state pinball machines that ever came out. And I don't know how many were ever made. When I talked to one of the engineers, and that's an interesting story, when I had to get rid of the pinball machine, I started looking on LinkedIn and Facebook, and I found an engineer who, if you think I'm old, he's even older than I am. And I called him up, and I go, Tommy? He goes, yes. I go, it's Schubel. And there's a pause as the neurons are going for some 70-year-old guy. And he goes, Schubel, I haven't talked to you in 35 years. I go, I know. I said, do you want a pinball machine? He goes, no, I'm old. I said, okay. And so at least I offered him pinball machine because he was one of the developers. But I asked him to tell me anything he could about the early development of the machine. And so he did a brain dump on me, and we got some information which I'll share with you. But I asked him, I said, well, how many of these things were ever made? And he says, you know, when I went to Coffee Mat, I saw them lined up, and my guess was about a couple of hundred. But he says, I just don't know. and I really don't know either, really where that whole business line of business went with Coffee Matt. So what happened was, after we went through the whole development, my dad got one of the original wipeouts, and it went from the factory to my dad's house and then to my basement. So it was never commercially played. So it was really in perfect shape. I mean, if you looked at it, after 35 years, essentially, the rubber had gotten old and you'd have to replace the rubber bands. But other than that, it was a, you know, totally new pinball machine that was 35 years old. And as Rob said, Dave Silverman bid and won on it on eBay, and he came and picked it up. And I'm glad it has a home, because otherwise it's going in the dumpster. Because I put it on Craigslist for about 2 months. I put it on eBay. I got people yelling at me like, this is not real, this is not a solid state, Stearns was the first one, or whatever they're telling me. And I'm not a pinhead. Matter of fact, I didn't know if I had to come in here with a pop bumper hat or something, but apparently nobody does that, so that's okay. But I wasn't going to argue with anybody. I just said, I got this thing, I think it's interesting, and somebody should buy it so I don't throw it out. And that's Wipeout. So, I mean, it was on a surfer theme, and it was 1 or 2 player. The gameplay was sort of, you had to spell Wipeout, and then all the things would go on, and you would spell it by going through the channels up at the top, and the lights would go on, O-U-T, and then you would increment the lights by hitting the center thing, and you would move the lights across. I mean, it was a very simple play. It wasn't three-dimensional. It was really only on one level. But again, you know, it was back in the 70s, so we're not talking about the evolution that's happened at that point. And if anybody's interested in this PowerPoint after, I mean, I can email it to you. My email address is... right. The email address I'll put back up at the end, so if you want a copy of this. So let me just talk a little bit about the history. The engineers at Numax that made this product, the electronics pack, was Ray Grimm, who did hardware, Tommy Shuren, who did software, Dick Brashears, who did software, Rudy DiGirolamo was an engineer doing generic stuff, Todd was a tech, and I was a tech. So I was working at my dad's company as an engineering tech, and this was one of the things that I got to deal with. And then Mahendra Desai, Mac, we called him, was the liaison engineer at Coffee Matt that we dealt with. So if any of those names mean anything to anybody, I just figured I'd give them credits here for posterity. Now, we did actually go to production with these boards. This was not wire wrap. These were not proto boards. These were, you know, pure printed circuit boards that were in production. There was the main board was in the back panel. It used the 8080 microprocessor, and it used EEPROMs, which were UV erasable. You know, you guys have to remember, in the 70s, there weren't PCs, there weren't flash drives. When you had to burn a program into the board, you had these chips, and then they would get burned in, and then you'd have to erase them with an ultraviolet light, and you'd put a little tape over the top so it wouldn't get erased. This was all history on how this stuff all went. And that's the motherboard. So this is in the back panel, and these were the double EEPROMs. And they were white and ceramic because they couldn't get hot or something, and that was with that. Then you had the display boards up there. And then underneath in the bottom, okay, so that's another view of it. Probably looks pretty traditional today. There was a high voltage board in the bottom. And that's where we had to deal with the solenoids and pop bumpers and all that other stuff. And the issue, according to Tommy, and I'm giving him some notoriety here, is this was the hardest part. The designing the board, the software, we got through that. That wasn't an issue. The issue back then was mixing high voltage circuitry for the solenoids and pop bumpers with the microprocessor circuitry. The boards were frying. So, you know, today this stuff is... microprocessors do control high-voltage things. I mean, the interface electronics deal with that. But again, we're talking back in the mid-70s. It wasn't there yet. So that was actually the biggest challenge we had in the whole design was the high-voltage board. Now, how we developed this thing was, I think, pretty interesting. And again, there were no PCs. So when Intel came out with the 8080, they had to give you a development environment so that you could actually write software for it. So they had a thing called the Intel Microprocessor Development System. Anybody ever hear of that or see one of those? Okay, I have a picture of it. You would key the program in a teletype. Okay, there was no CRT. And it would store on a paper tape. There was no floppies. Now, eventually, they added a CRT, and eventually they added dual 8-inch floppies that were single-sided that hold 250K each. And then we added a printer. And what the MDS looked like was this. It was the device on the right, and the teletype was on the left. And if you see on the left of that, there's the paper tape. It was about a 1-inch paper tape that punched holes. And each version of the code we did went into a shoebox. And we'd close the shoebox and write the version on the code in the shoebox. And when you wanted to run it, you'd put the thing in there and it'd run through the teletype, pull it into the MDS, and then you'd have a working version of the code. Now, how would we debug this thing? Well, Intel gave us a thing called ICE 80. Anybody have an idea what that is? There you go. Boy. ICE 80 allowed us to connect this engine, the MDS, to the processor board via that cable. And then we could actually step through the program via the teletype connected to MDS, having ICE 80 putting it into the processor board. So that's how we would debug this thing. We'd be able to, when we would run the whole thing through that, we'd be able to stop, we'd be able to change a variable, but we'd be able to do that in real time with ICE. And you know, that was how we had to do this. Now, some of the things that made this interesting was that these guys had to be good when they wrote code in those days. There was no BASIC, there was no C, there was no any of this. We had no assembler. Anybody know assembler? Okay, I don't. I jumped in the BASIC days, and I jumped in the RPG days. I work on a system called an iSeries, an AS400. But these guys predated me and had a no assembler. The entire code for Wipeout was 3 to 4K. Okay, so that's small. Because memory was expensive then, right? So you had to optimize things. So people wrote in assembly. They didn't have high-level languages and compile it down. It was, you had to really optimize it. And the compiling or the assembling of this took 4 hours. So every time you made a change, it was a big deal. It was an event to compile this thing because you'd waste half a day waiting for that to happen. So the engineers got better, and they started just debugging in machine code. So they'd go poke in the machine code instructions and make the changes to avoid having to do a recompile. So that was the type of things that we had to do. And it was, I would say, a whole lot more interesting than somebody today having a program in a high-level language with the capabilities you have. These guys were really good when they did this. And they were doing it really as pioneers. So, for those that don't know software, and I don't pretend to know it, you have to think of what goes on here. So you hit the side bumper, the bumper in front of the flipper, and a switch will close. You'll interrupt the processor. You'll determine which switch was hit. You'd look up the number of points in a table somewhere. Then you'd add points to the counter. You'd increment the display. You'd turn on a light or something, and you'd activate a solenoid or a pop bumper. So you had the event, which was the ball hitting the switch, had to make all that happen. Okay, now that is sort of simplifying it, but these are all sets of instructions that had to happen in the system. And that is a problem, because in a pinball machine, everything is random, right? So when the ball hits that, where it ends up after that could be 100 different places, right? And it could be happening multiple times a second, right? So you got the ball going around doing random events. And what happens when it hangs? That's a problem. If you're doing traditional programming, you're doing an invoicing run, it starts at the beginning, it reads all the customer invoices, it prints them out, and it ends. And if it fails at customer 200, well, then you can look at what's wrong with customer 201, right? So you could sort of figure out some reason why the code didn't work. But
when you're running something that's event-driven and you have no idea where anything's going to happen and it fails, how do you debug that? Well, that was my job. I got to play this game for hours and days and days and days. And what they did was they had the game set up with a video camera. Now, everybody's got little webcams now, but back in the 70s, we had to get industrial level video cameras, position it above the gameplay, and I had to play the game for days and hours. When the thing hung, you know, got dashes across the LEDs or stopped hearing noises, we'd stop the video, we'd go into the room, and we'd play it back in slow motion, and we'd be able to see it hit this, it hit this, it hit this, it hit, that's, you know, and then we'd go back to the software, do the machine code instructions, change it, reburn it, then actually manually hit the things to see if we fixed it, and then resume play. So I don't know, you know, I figure that was some neat tidbit because, you know, this was behind the scenes stuff in the 70s, and, you know, you guys play this stuff, and it's just happening, but we were sweating in those days because you don't want, you know, to be playing and the thing hanging. And, you know, that would disturb a customer. So we spent a lot of time trying to make sure that we gave a high-quality way, and this was the only way we knew how to do it. Remember, I think we were pioneers in this realm. Anybody ever hear about doing it like that? Has anybody done it like that? Really? Somebody said yes? So additional photos. Okay, this was set up for 2 plays per coin, 3 balls per play. Extra ball at 20, 40, and 80,000, tilt, whatever. Awards, there's a, you know, whole thing of that. Free ball when the light was hit. That's always fun. That's, again, the top of the gameplay. The bottom, again, we'd increment wipeout all the way across. This was the bottom of the board. They all look pretty similar today. I mean, that pretty much hasn't changed. This was looking in. That was the high voltage board on the bottom. And then on the top, that's the gameplay. This was the counter. This was, if you can see it, this was the tilt. So there's the bobber for the tilt that would touch. And then there was something for, I think, shock. Is that common today with the ball on an angle like that? Yeah. So that was up on that. So we had that. What else? Okay. Yep.
Typically, we rate systems like this by how many switches they can read as inputs, how many lamps they control, and how many solenoids they control. Remember those numbers?
No. I mean, we could probably add it up on the gameplay, you know, by looking at the gameplay. So I could send you the PowerPoint, and you could look at the pictures and figure that out. We did not, I will tell you that there was headroom left in the architecture for other games. So this one might have been simple, but we didn't tap out the hardware with that. The design was such that if they came out with another one, it was just a matter of software. Okay, so now we said the Lost Coffee Mat Pinball Machines. Star Battle. Who's played Star Battle? This gentleman. Another one, wow. Okay, so let's talk about Star Battle. I have no clue what Star Battle is. When my dad got shipped Wipeout, he also got shipped Star Battle. And we looked at this and says, what's that about? And it was another solid-state pinball machine that came from Coffee Mat. And they looks like they double-sourced the electronics because they didn't know if we could perform. So that's the nearest we could have figured it. But the president of Coffee Mat gave my dad a Star Battle. And so I have a Star Battle. I have no idea who developed the board in Star Battle. I have no idea about anything other than I have the thing. And that's what it looks like. So it went from Coffee Mat to my dad's living room. And it sits there to this day. And it plays. So it's absolutely pristine. I don't know if this was one of the first coffee table type machines, and I don't know how many of these they made. All I know is I think this one, and I have the placard, is serial number 210, so they had to make 210 of them. Gameplay on this one, again, pretty simple, but a lot of fun. I got to tell you, you sit there, watch TV, and you play this in front of the TV. It was a pretty interesting concept.
Two player.
I get closer here. Player one, player two. It was serial number 210. The model was Star Battle SB by Coffee Matt. I have the instruction panel here. And also, if anybody's interested, I actually have the book. Inside the thing was a manual, probably about 20 or 30 pages that gives a little bit of the, I guess, debugging stuff and whatever. But if somebody needs it, send me an email and I'll photocopy it for you. But I don't know if there's any of these things around. When you lift it up, that's the bottom of the play area. Motherboard is over here. And then there's their high voltage board was over here. Again, none of that was from Numax. Don't know what planet that came from. Star Battle, I guess. Some pictures of the inside. They had circuit breakers on the bottom. And the board on the right is the motherboard. Then that was their tilt pendulum there. And some more pictures here. And this, I think, is probably cool. And probably this is probably the holy grail of somebody in here. My brother holds the cap for this one. So we kept writing down high games. So we were in my parents' house, and then 1978, when we're playing this thing, and my brother said, we got to keep a log of this for posterity. So inside the game, before I came here, I opened it up and I found this piece of paper in there. And we started out at 320,400, and we kept getting better and better, and my brother kept trumping me. And on 9/21/79, my brother hit 1,592,000. Now, why that's interesting is the next thing, which I had to decipher. He wrote approximately 1.8 million, but the score reverts to 1.500 after 15999. So he probably hit the top of the machine as far as points. And that, you know, I don't know, has anybody ever run a machine to the end where the points got bad? That's pretty good. Okay, but I thought that was pretty cool. So as far as Star Battle goes, if anybody ever finds one and they get this high, then they're in some new territory as far as scoring. So that's the story. And so we still have Star Battle. It's still in my dad's house. We're selling his house, and Star Battle might, you know, I don't know, we'll probably put that on eBay again or something like that. Who knows? Hopefully it doesn't have to go in a dumpster, but... But anyway, I'm glad to be able to talk about this and maybe give you a little history of these things. There's probably a lot of history known on the standard brands of pinball machines, but this one, Coffee Matt, you know, if you find one around, then you can just look and say, hey, yeah, I got to know a little bit about that thing. So, any questions? Yes?
This is for the historical record. There was some note of a third title called Cosmic Wars. Does that title ring a bell?
Nope.
Okay, how about the same title, Star Battle, being made under the nameplate of Century Consolidated Industries?
Don't know.
Or can you call Circus Circus?
Nope, by Coffee Matt?
That one's also credited to Century, but it could have been done before.
You know what? Don't know. They might have sold the rights to this stuff. I actually tried to do some research before this, and Coffee Matt sort of just went away. I think they got bought by somebody in Idaho, and it was just not any good information. I dug deep. I even tried to find old engineers, and as I said, Tommy Sherman was pretty old. But, you know, hopefully, you know, keep some information alive here, and maybe Dave will get the thing set up in the museum and people can play it again. But it does work. Problem is, you know, if anything goes wrong with the electronics, it's not like you can get another Stearns motherboard from somewhere. I mean, this thing was unique, and I don't, you know, somebody without any electronics, it's probably great while it runs, but the day it stops, it's like, you know, is what it is. Any other questions? Yes. 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 Coffee Matt make? Yeah. Coffee Matt made coffee machines. You put a quarter in, you put the cup in there, and, you know, the coffee would come out. So that was what they did. And they started the amusement division to make pinball machines. Yes, sir.
They shoot your game inside the electronics, or
we developed the electronics without a game. They were making the cabinet and the gameplay, and they just said, you're going to have pop bumpers here, this, that, and, you know, they pretty much told us what it had to do, and we never even saw the game. Then, after we were done developing it, they sent us a box that we could actually play it. But this thing was developed without even seeing the game. We had no clue what the thing looked like. I probably think they did that because I think that they weren't a creative type company. They were making coffee machines, right? So I think they would have had to have somebody on that side. Yes, sir.
How did the control system for the Star Battle from the unknown company compare to your system?
They worked. And I don't know any more details than that. You know, if you ask me to compare these things, they worked. Sorry. Anything else? Well, thank you very much.